And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're talking to, you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. Every show has a theme. Today's theme is making decisions. Each of my guests is talking to us about making decisions in both our life and in business. My first guest was talking to us about the decisions, practical wisdom that you can make, doing the right thing at the right time every single time. My second guest was Jane Wells from CNBC, and Jane talked to us about the recent Apple announcement and also the earnings coming out of there and Steve Jobs' health. My next guest believes that there's a price on his head, and he believes there's a price on my head and your head as well. In fact, he believes that everything has a price associated with it. We'll discuss his latest book, The Price of Everything, Solving the Mystery of Why We Pay What We Do. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. My guest, Eduardo Porter, is on the staff of the New York Times. He's been on that staff since 2004, overseeing economics. He joined the paper's editorial board in July of 2007. He began his journalism career as a financial reporter for Notimex, the Mexican news agency in Mexico City, back in 1990. Eduardo was appointed the editor of the Brazilian edition of America Economica, a business and economics magazine based in Sao Paulo, Brazil, in 1996. He became the senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal based in Los Angeles, covering Hispanic population in the United States. Eduardo is a graduate of the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de Mexico, and he holds a master's in science in quantum fields and fundamental forces from the Imperial College of Science, Technology, and Medicine in London. Welcome to the show, Eduardo. How are you today?
I am very well. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I enjoy talking to thought leaders in all aspects, and you are clearly a thought leader in business. And your book, The Price of Everything, has just some amazing stories and examples to give about how crazy and convoluted we get in our thinking when it comes to the decisions that we make. But before we dive into that, I teased everybody at the top of the show saying that you think you've got a price on your head and that everybody has a price on their head. Everything and everybody does have a price associated with it. This is really not a new concept, is it? I mean, it goes back to the 1500s when Lloyd's of London started insuring ships and their cargo. Today, we see it in actuarial tables from insurance companies. Everything has a price associated with it. When I came out here to California, I started in the oil industry. Not only did my life have a price associated with it, but each limb I had a price associated with it. Lose a finger, get this much. Lose a hand, get this much. Your book uncovers the logical aspects of decision-making when you base it on prices and value. Tell us the story that in my mind really got this whole thing started. It's the story of the migrant farm worker that you were interviewing trying to bring his family to the United States. That really helped to conceptualize your book for me.
That was the story that probably led me to write this book. It was a conversation I had, some 8, maybe 9 years ago with an immigrant farm worker, an illegal immigrant, in the San Joaquin Valley in California. He was at the time, I think, in the asparagus crop, earning about $7 an hour. And he was talking to me about his decision about how to bring his two young children into the United States illegally to be with him. And his two options seemed to be bringing his children over the Arizona desert, what he called over the hill, which would cost him about $1,500 per child paid to a smuggler, or bringing them over a regular checkpoint using some fake document, like a fake green card or so on. And that would cost him about $5,000 per child. And however, he was deciding between, between life and death, because bringing his children over the desert implied it was a much, much more dangerous kind of journey, where the chances of something bad happening to the children were fairly high. Yet, for him, this was a real decision that pit, something of extreme fundamental value in terms of dollars and cents. And this isn't the only thing that was happening at the time that led me to think in this way. If you recall, right around then, Ken Feinberg, a lawyer, was the special master running the fund set up by Congress to compensate the families of the victims of 9/11. And he was engaging in a similar sort of exercise. He had to price the life of the people who had perished in the terrorist attacks in order to compensate their families. And the way he was doing it was by assessing kind of like what the overall wage of each, you know, victim would have been throughout the rest of their lifetime in order to value, in order to find a value for each one of them. So, for instance, he decided there were some people that ultimately were valued at $6.4 million, whereas others were valued at about $250,000. Men were valued at, were given a higher value than women. The middle-aged were given a higher value than the old. It led to all sorts of very weird comparisons about what people are really worth. And those two things sort of like stayed with me to this day. And you were talking about Steve Jobs earlier today, and I was thinking, well, you know, did you see that the stock price, the Apple stock price, fell about 4% on opening yesterday?
Yes.
And I was wondering, well, there it seemed to me shareholders were valuing Jobs' presence, Jobs' life, his presence at the head of the company, at, you know, about 4% of Apple, which, you know, about $12, $15 billion.
That's incredible, and that's a great current example to show the point that you're trying to make. Now, in the case of Ken Feinberg, you're talking, Eduardo, really about just doing a net present value assessment of what each of us would earn over the course of their lifetime, which I find is a fairly reasonable, logical way to approach that. Did you find any fault in his logic?
I do not. The logic is ultimately sound, but clearly that's not how you would value your life or how I would value mine. In fact, Feinberg wrote a book called The Value of Life, or What's Life Worth? I can't remember exactly the title, but he wrote a book about his experience at the head of this fund, and he related, you know, kind of like the problems that some of the relatives had with his assessment of value, which was not at all like theirs. So, for instance, there was this one woman who thought that the value of her husband had to be higher because he had lived longer and had therefore suffered more before dying in the attacks. Or another who thought that her husband had to be worth more to her because their marriage had been a very long-lasting one, so it had to be worth more than a husband in a relatively recent marriage. And if you would put to, I would venture that if you were to put to any of your listeners how much they value their own life, they would probably not value it in terms of net present value. They would probably value it at, you know, infinity or whatever resources they had at their command, right?
Right. Well, that's the way we all view it. But in reality, you have to make these economic assessments all the time. You do it if you're in a position where you can buy life insurance. You make those decisions all the time. You decide how much policy you can afford, how much you need to have to pay off the mortgage and things like that if you should die. And you base that decision on some very logical steps.
And in fact, I mean, we actually put a price on the probability of dying every day. Just think of, you know, crossing the street. Crossing the street is increasing slightly our chance of getting run over by a car, and we're doing that because we expect to gain something from getting to the other side. And or let's put a more numerical example onto this. Think of speeding. Remember the 55-mile per hour speed limit?
Absolutely, I do.
70s?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was relaxed in the 1980s. States were given the opportunity to increase the speed limit to 65, and several states did. And what happened then was, in those states that did increase the speed limit, driving got faster. Drivers, you know, drove faster. Their commutes shortened, and the fatality rates on the roads increased. And so you could actually work out that every additional death resulted in the saving of 125,000 hours in shorter commutes. Now, if you plugged in the average wage into that, you could decide that, you know, that drivers were basically trading a life for $2.1 million. So saving $2.1 million was worth an extra death, say. So that's kind of like people pricing life. And in fact, governments today use those kinds of estimates that people do when they make their choices as to, you know, where to live, how fast to drive, you know, what kind of safety devices to buy, to assess how much they're valuing their chances of dying and therefore how much they're valuing their own life. And they do this in order to, you know, make investments in public safety, in better roads, in you know, in providing public medicine, in order to be able to assess how much it's worth the government to invest in each of these things.
All right. We're talking to Eduardo Porter, everybody. His latest book, The Price of Everything, Solving the Mystery of Why We Pay What We Do. And, Eduardo, I want to talk about some of the other measures of value that we place. It's not just money. You and I have been talking a lot about money. But what are some of the other proxies, or what are some of the other tools for measuring value in our society?
Right. I mean,
cash, credit, things like that.
Well, you have all these kind of like monetary and pseudo money kind of forms. Yes, cash, credit, cigarettes. There's a great story of a British official that was imprisoned in World War II and kept in prisoner of war camps for a couple of years. And after he came out at the end of the war, he wrote this book about the economy of these camps, and where he described an economy that worked pretty much like the economy you and I know that works on dollars, except that it worked on cigarettes. You know, and when the Red Cross delivered, you know, its stock of cigarettes, there would be inflation because the price of getting, you know, of getting a service rose from 2 cigarettes to 4 cigarettes. And as cigarettes got smoked, inflation could turn to deflation because there were fewer cigarettes to go around. And this kind of economy existed in American prisons for a very long time, where cigarettes were kind of like used as a currency to trade for all sorts of services and favors within the prisons. And it died when smoking was banned in federal prisons in 2004, and it was replaced, in many prisons it was replaced, you know, with what? With cans of mackerel. You know, cans of mackerel that you could buy at the prison commissary using, you know, the wage that was deposited by prison authorities for jobs that you did for the prison. You could use those to buy canned mackerel, and that was the money for the economy between the prisoners.
Holy mackerel, what a story. We're talking to Eduardo Porter. Eduardo, your book is probably one of the best books that I've ever read on discussing the whole thought of opportunity cost. And in our society, where really the most precious commodity that we have, and by the way, it's the only thing that's equal throughout the world, that is the value of time. So to discuss opportunity cost in terms of time and how we value those things.
Well, I mean, opportunity cost is the best way of understanding a price, right? I mean, the price of the $5 slice of pizza is all the other things that you could have done with those $5, but you didn't do because you spent them on the pizza. And you can use that in every decision in your life. You know, the price of getting married is the glories of the single life that you just traded away. You can use this in all sorts of dimensions, whether you're thinking of money or not. And in particular, whether you're thinking of time, people value their time, and so therefore they will be willing to trade it for a certain good or service. And different people will have different values to their time. I mean, think of it. I mean, there's a couple of examples that come to mind that I find interesting. One is an experiment that happened in Denver in the mid 1990s, where some economists got a lot of data about what shoppers paid for their weekly groceries. They measured thousands of families over 2 years, and they had data about how old they were, what their family income was, how big the family was, alongside data about what they bought and how much they paid for it. And they found that people who were wealthier, people who made $70,000 a year or more, paid 5% more for the exact same groceries as people who made $30,000 a year or less. And now this is exactly an example of people valuing time differently. I mean, think of it this way. If you're a janitor, say, making $11 an hour, and somebody were to come and offer you the choice between $100 and an extra day of leisure, chances are you'd take the $100. It would be, you know, a good deal. Mm-hmm. But if you're a lawyer earning $500 an hour and somebody were to make you the same offer, chances are you'd take the free time rather than the money. That's because your time is worth more. So if you move that into the grocery store for the grocery store example, you can see it this way. The janitor is going to spend time clipping coupons, waiting for specials, comparison shopping in order to get the best possible deal for his groceries. Whereas a lawyer, she will just pick up stuff without really even looking at the price tag because she can't really spend time doing that. Her time is more valuable than that, and therefore she'll end up paying more for the same groceries.
All right, we're talking to Eduardo Porter, everybody. His book, The Price of Everything, Solving the Mystery of Why We Pay What We Do. Eduardo, is capitalism the most efficient way to set the price of things?
In capitalism, prices are what allocate resources. I mean, in other non-capitalistic societies, prices and resources, prices are set and resources allocated by government fiat. And I haven't yet seen a government that has the ability to allocate resources across an economy in a way that does not sort of inhibit economic development. I relate in the price of everything trip I made to Cuba a long time ago, in which I was driven around town by this haggard, thin, undernourished woman who, you know, found it to be a good deal to drive me around town for $10 a day.
Mm.
And you know, soon I discovered that she happened to be a pediatrician that worked in the main hospital in town. And I was wondering, well, how could this be an efficient allocation of resources? How was her labor priced in such a way that for her it made more sense to drive me around in her beaten-up Lada for $10 a day than to be, you know, working as a pediatrician? And to my mind, that kind of underscores the perils of sort of like of central planning, that it, resources are allocated at the whim of a bureaucrat, and that, you know, maybe, the, you know, it might make sense in a particular instance, but it, chances are it won't.
All right. We're talking to Eduardo Porter, everybody. The book, The Price of Everything. Eduardo, let's bring this down to a more practical level. Let's talk about some of the examples in your book and something that we can all relate to. Certainly my listeners can, and that is the price of marriage. Now, here's my thesis. My thesis is I've long believed that marriage is a contract that should be renewed every 7 years. But that's just a personal belief. Now, talk to us about marriage and the attendant prices that go along with getting married.
Well, a marriage is definitely a contract. It's a contract in which, you know, the traditional deal was men would provide sustenance from the labor market, you know, the farm or the hunt or the factory, plus sperm, and women would provide an egg, a womb, and a child care. And all of the purpose of this trade was to, you know, satisfy the evolutionary imperative of having our genes passed down to the next generation, meaning having children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were many institutions that that worked for this imperative, and one of them that lasted for a very long time was polygamy. Polygamy served men's purpose of planting their sperm in as many women as possible, and therefore increasing their chances of having successful kids passed to the next generation. And that's because sperm is relatively cheap to produce, so the cost to them of having children with many, many women was very low. Women, by contrast, who have to invest a lot in having children, you know, they have to carry them to term, 9 months, they had to be much more careful about their choice of mates. So they weren't after quantity, they were after quality. For women, it was crucially important to have high-quality mates that could, you know, care for them and provide sustenance until the child was brought to term, and even further on. And so their strategy also worked with polygamy, because polygamy allowed more women to mate with the highest quality men in a group, you know, those that had more resources. And so you'd have the most resourceful men, the richest men of the group, would have several women. And so we tend to think that polygamy disappeared because it was bad for women, but actually what happened is it waned because it wasn't very good for many men. Because though it was good for the men that had a lot of resources, it was terrible for the poorer men who did not have these resources and were therefore left kind of like they were pushed out of the gene pool. They weren't given a chance to mate and reproduce. And so this wasn't good at all for kind of social cohesion, and it was great for civil strife.
Ah, that's a great story. It's a great analysis. It's one of the many good stories in the book, The Price of Everything, Solving the Mystery of Why We Pay What We Do. We're talking to the author, Eduardo Porter. Eduardo, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about your book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Oh, they should go to my website. It's eduardoporter.com. That's E-D-U-A-R-D-O, porter.com. I've got that, these and other stories up there.
Oh, that's wonderful. Eduardo, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.